Al-Hurrami Yazid al-Riyahi didn't want to start any combat or any military clash against Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. And one of the reasons is that when it was a time for Salat, Al-Hurrami Yazid al-Riyahi stood behind Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and prayed behind Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. And it means that, religiously speaking, he believed in Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. However, politically speaking, he was still attached to the Umayyad government and hegemony.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspect of our life.
Well, in a conversation with Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, Al-Hurrami Yazid al-Riyahi intended to threaten Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, and when he received a harsh feedback and answer, and in fact a very severe setback of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, in which Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam mentioned and made reference to Al-Hurrami Yazid al-Riyahi's mother, Al-Hurrami Yazid al-Riyahi never answered anything. I mean, he swallowed his anger and expressed that he wouldn't say anything because Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam's mother was none but Hazrat Fatima Zahra salamullah alayha. Because Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam noticed that Al-Hurrami Yazid al-Riyahi paid respect to Imam al-Husayn's mother, that is Hazrat Fatima Zahra salamullah alayha, we find that the attitude of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam toward Al-Hurrami Yazid al-Riyahi changed, and Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam never initiated any war against Al-Hurrami Yazid al-Riyahi and the army under his command. This is because of, I mean, two reasons. First of all, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was the Imam of peace and peacemaking, and he was never the Imam of initiating any war. This is one. And the second reason is that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam realized that Al-Hurrami Yazid al-Riyahi was a believer. I mean, religiously speaking, he was a believer. However, from the point of his formal obligations and commitment, he was still on the side of the Umayyads. Several days passed by in this way, until it was the day of Ashura. When it was on the day of Ashura in the morning, Al-Hurrami Yazid al-Riyahi realized that it wasn't just a military maneuver or a kind of military showing off, or rather it was going to be a very harsh military clash between the two camps. And he noticed that Umar ibn Sa'd initiated the war and shot the first arrow toward the camp of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. When Al-Hurrami Yazid al-Riyahi understood that in that battle, the Umayyad side, I mean, more than in 30,000 soldiers would certainly martyr whoever would be on the way in the camp of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, Al-Hurrami Yazid al-Riyahi realized that any moment he would spend with the Umayyad camp would certainly be regarded as his big crime. Not big sin, but big crime. Because of this, Al-Hurrami Yazid al-Riyahi left the files and ranks of the Umayyad camp, I mean, where he was a commander, and joined Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam as a simple servant and as a simple soldier.
Thank you.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
French President Emmanuel Macron recently said he wanted a review of his country's military policies on the African continent and had asked his ministers and army chiefs to work on it.
J'ai demandé au ministre et au chef.
I have asked the Defense Minister, Sébastien Lecornu, and the Joint Chief of Staff to rethink by next autumn the entirety of our military presence in Africa.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and it's always great welcoming you here at Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative analysis of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on efforts by France to reboot its diminishing neo-colonial influence in Africa. By pursuing such a policy, France is clearly ignoring the voices of most Africans who want to see an end to the negative influence of former colonial powers in the continent. The second part of our program will be on a new report showing that African governments owe 3 times more debt to Western private lenders than to China and are charged double the interest. So stay tuned till the end of our show today.
France rebooting neo-colonialism in Africa. French President Emmanuel Macron said last month that he wanted a rethink of all his country's military postures on the African continent by the first half of 2023. The operational overhaul is said to have an impact notably on the country's involvement in the Sahel region. The remarks by Macron were followed by a visit to 3 African countries in what is seen as deliberate efforts by Paris to strengthen, revive, and rejuvenate its imperialism in Africa. Despite the efforts by Macron, France is still perceived negatively in Africa.
In May this year, demonstrators from the South African Economic Freedom Fighters Party marched to the French embassy in Pretoria and demanded that France should leave Africa. Party leader Julius Malema said French colonialism in Africa is the most brutal. Let's take a listen.
French colonialism in the African continent continues to be the most brutal, cruel, and devilish form of colonialism in the African continent. We, as a generation of freedom fighters, reject and condemn the fact that decades after the declaration of so-called independence of former colonized territories, colonizers continue to maintain a colonial and neo-colonial relationship with African countries which are supposed to be free from colonial control.
Well, for more on how France is reshaping its neo-colonial strategies in Africa, we have contacted Nestor Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, President Emmanuel Macron of France wants a rethink of all of his country's military posters on the African continent, and he even asked his ministers and army chiefs to work on it. What's your take on this statement?
Mm-hmm. So it's a necessary reconsideration that they have to make because of the crisis of imperialism and the fact that neocolonialism is on its last leg in the continent of Africa, particularly in the African neo-colonies. When we think about Mali in particular, and just all of them, Burkina Faso, all of these different places where France's military footprint is not being seen favorably by the masses of the people, and naturally so, then they and imperialism, not just France, but all of them, have nothing else to offer, no other means of enforcing their hegemony but through militarization and militarism, then they have to rethink what are they going to do. So they've already been kicked out of Mali and have to withdraw their troops from there. And so right now they're in a waning position.
In recent years, protests against the presence of France in its former African colonies have been on the rise, particularly in West African countries such as Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, and Chad. Last year, French troops on their way to central Mali from Burkina Faso killed two such protesters in a Nigerian town. A Malian activist says they are opposed to French imperialism and control in the region.
Nous ne sommes pas contre la France, nous ne sommes pas contre les Français, mais oui, nous sommes contre la politique française au Mali, nous sommes contre la politique française au Sahel.
There have been protests against the French military in several West African countries, as you earlier mentioned. So why is France insisting on imposing itself on Africa while ignoring popular opinion in the continent?
All the current, what we call neocolonial powers, have to ignore popular opinion. It is natural, because popular opinion is tied to the natural inherent aspirations of self-determination. And self-determination is antithetical to neocolonialism and neocolonial interests. So neocolonialism exists to extract and the wealth and the resources to impose its markets and, you know, its economy, control the economies. And all of that is the exploitation of Africa, which is, you know, people don't want that. And so popular opinion is really an expression, no matter how, you know, essentially speaking, when we boil it down, is an expression of the desire to self-determination.
French President Emmanuel Macron's trip to West Africa last month was touted by Paris as his latest effort to reshape France's relations with his former colonies in Africa. But the visit's short-term fanfare is unlikely to halt deepening opposition to France or slow down its declining influence in the region. The continued plundering of Africa is critical for the survival of Western economies.
They're trying to find ways to address this irreversible economic crisis of imperialism. And then right now we're seeing in a world where these the tensions are high, particularly like with the NATO war against Russia, that it's making extremes in terms of even Europe is facing shortages of goods and the disruption of the trade routes and things like that, oil and all that. And so right now they have to look to, and then they also are concerned, also they're concerned about Russia's and China's relationship on the African continent. So right now, their objectives have to be, and they know that they can't, that militarism is not faring well. So they have to figure out and search for other means to sustain their interests and their hegemony in this area.
Niger, the world's poorest country, according to the UN's Human Development Index, is increasingly becoming a center of Western military expansionism in Africa. Although Niger regained independence from France in 1960, the former colonial power still plunders the country's rich natural resources. Now, France's foreign and military ministers recently visited Niger, a key partner of Paris in the Sahel. What is the role of this uranium-rich country in France's renewed neocolonial push in Africa?
They participate in this military exercise, the African Lion, it's called. It's a very joint military exercise with all these different countries, Western countries and African countries, trying to, in their so-called interest to combat terrorism and extreme, you know, these violent insurgents, as they refer to them, although they really should be seen as that themselves, because they don't really bring the stability to the continent of Africa. So Niger is still in a position to, at least the elite of it, because the masses of the people in none of these countries really want the presence of these former colonial powers and these current neocolonial powers. So they're seeing Niger as a partner and trying to beef up this, what their so-called war against terrorism, and then also trying to figure out how they place themselves strategically in Africa, where their influence is waning. Influence waning all the way up to the state level, and for example, in Mali, the state itself.
During his visit to Cameroon, French President Emmanuel Macron denounced what he claimed was hypocrisy expressed by African countries regarding Russia's military operation in Ukraine.
The choice that has been made by the Europeans, firstly, is in no way to participate in this war, but to recognize it and to name it. I have seen too much hypocrisy, particularly on the African continent, and I'm saying this very calmly, with some not calling it a war when it is one, and saying they don't know who started it because they are diplomatic pressures.
These remarks by Macron are not surprising, as they further reveal his neo-colonial and patronizing attitude towards the people of Africa.
And my last question. Now, will France succeed in re-establishing its waning influence in Africa, especially in view of competition from other powers such as Russia, China, and Turkey?
Even if they were to get some reestablished, to gain back some influence, we have to be mindful. I think one of the things that will be informative is the insightful and seminal work of Kwame Nkrumah, that neocolonialism is the last stage of imperialism. There is no other stage, for imperialism to have in terms of maintaining itself. And so an imperialism is in a state of crisis. Imperialism meaning the dominance and the hegemony of these Western powers over the economies, political life, and even culture of the places. People are no longer going to stand for it. It's exposed to be the existential threat that it is to the masses of the people, at least on the continent of Africa, and it's getting so other places. And so, it can't reestablish it. It can only maybe get a little bit of its control back. But that's only a temporary thing.
Well, there you have it. Neocolonialism is the last stage of imperialism, and the masses in Africa are resolute in reasserting their independence. Thanks a lot, Nefta Freeman, for your in-depth analysis. We now take a short break before our next topic, which is on how private Western lenders are increasing the debt burden in Africa.
African debt burden blamed on Western lenders.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
According to a report released recently by a UK-based charity, Debt Justice, African governments owe three times more debt to Western private lenders than to China and are charged double the interest.
Citing calculations based on World Bank data, the report said that just 12% of African governments' external debt is owed to Chinese lenders, compared to 35% owed to Western private lenders.
Now, African experts say that the debt trap narrative propagated against China is part of a wider geopolitical rivalry between West and China.
The debt trap issue has always been a political, slander. A third of African debt is owed to asset managers, private banks, and all that. But interestingly, the West has loudmouthed. The monopoly of global media means they could shout from the rooftops and get everybody listening.
Now, to discuss how private Western lenders have chained Africa to a heavy debt burden, we have contacted Lawrence Freeman, a political economic analyst for Africa. Thanks for joining us today, sir.
Great to be with you.
Now, the report released by the UK-based charity Debt Justice in July confirmed that Western private lenders are hugely responsible for Africa's debt burden and not China. Now, this is seldom in the mainstream media, and all we hear is so-called China debt trap. Now, is there a conspiracy of silence here?
What we've seen over the last several years is that there's been just simply propaganda, outright lying, saying that China now is the biggest debtor, that the African countries have China as the biggest lender, and therefore they also have put forth this theory that China is deliberately indebting African nations above the means in which they can pay the debt, and then they would, the Chinese, presumably, when the Africans defaulted, they would take over these projects or actually their physical resources. And of course, none of this is true. Debt trap diplomacy doesn't exist. It's a propaganda lie by the West to attack China.
Tim Jones, head of policy at Debt Justice, says the UK and the US should rein in on private Western lenders because most international private debt contracts are made under British or US law. He adds that Western governments have failed to take on companies in their own countries who, unlike China, did not suspend debt repayments during the pandemic.
75% of the African economy is driven by the middle-income countries. Now, these are the countries that are having a challenge with the question of debt. So unless you recognize that without dealing with the pressure that countries like Egypt, Kenya, South Africa, Ghana are facing, that you'll not be doing much in terms of saying that you're helping the African economy.
Why are Western governments failing to compel private lenders to ease loan repayments from low-income countries to tackle a debt crisis?
You have to understand that for increasingly over the last half century, the United States and the West, but I know the United States the best, has moved away from any concern about actually developing and assisting and collaborating with African nations and other third world nations to develop their economies. They will not, as a matter of policy, they will not help countries actually economically develop. They're not interested in the kind of long-term, low-interest loans that African nations would need to build infrastructure. So they don't want low-interest loans. They don't want to make long-term investments. They allow the private sector to make quick buck overnight, big returns, and they could care less about what it takes to build up an economy and raise the standard of living of people.
China, unlike most Western countries, supports Africa in making infrastructure development a priority for economic revitalization. It encourages and supports Chinese enterprises to adapt various models to participate in the construction, investment, operation and management of infrastructure projects in Africa. The Kenyan president elaborates here.
Partnership with China is not a partnership based on China telling us what we need. It is a partnership of friends working together to meet Kenya's social economic agenda.
At the end of 2020, Western private creditors held $247 billion in debt from African countries, compared to $83 billion for China, $274 billion for multilateral institutions, and $93 billion for other public creditors. Africa continues to receive colossal amounts of money from Western lenders, yet many countries in the continent are still wallowing in poverty.
Most of them go to quick, high-return investments over the years. Most of these investments have been in the extractive industries of oil and gas, and they have obviously not gone into actual development. The United States and the West, for bulk of the last several decades, has been investing in extraction, even though they attack China for this. And it's mainly oil and gas. And they look for investments where they don't have to actually make any long-term commitment. What Africa needs, what all developing nations need, all nations actually need, is they need to develop and expand their infrastructure. Infrastructure is the platform of which an economy grows and develops.
The G7 countries have acknowledged that there is need for debt restructuring at a meeting last June. Now, leaders said that they will urge all relevant creditors, including private creditors, to get more involved in debt restructuring. An official of the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa says many African countries are in need of debt relief.
ECA is calling for debt suspension, debt services suspension. So far, only 32 African countries benefited from debt suspension by the IMF of a total of 9.3 billion. And we are arguing for more debt suspension, services suspension, and we are also arguing for on-lending of SDR, special drawing rights, so that African countries can have more access to international resources.
Western powers claim to champion for the rights of African countries, yet interest rates charged by their financial institutions for African loans are well above those of Chinese lenders. Now, what's your take on this?
This so-called concern for rights of Africans and African nations is really a false, is a false democracy. In other words, they don't really thinking about how to develop a nation. How do you make a democratic nation? How does a nation become democratic? The people have to be involved in making the decisions for the future of their country. Well, they can't do that if they live in poverty. And the West's so-called concern for human rights and democracy and other issues like this are, again, propaganda. The right to live, the right to have food, the right to have housing, the right to have a job, what Roosevelt once called the four freedoms. This is what is required, and the West has no concern. So when the West talks about, the United States talks about the rights of African nations, it is pure hypocrisy.
Despite promising signs of a continuing global economic recovery in 2022, the African debt situation is of great concern to many people in this continent, which has immense untapped potential. Now, how can Africa get itself out of this vicious cycle of high interest loans by Western lenders?
I have been advocating for many, many years, and I put out articles constantly on my website, Lawrence Freeman, Africa and the World.com. I call myself a follower of Alexander Hamilton. I refer to myself as a physical economist. And what we need is Hamiltonian banks where the capital of the bank is lent out on a preferred low interest basis for those investments in infrastructure and industry that will help the nation grow. I have now been working with a group for a couple of years of Africans to establish a African Infrastructure Development Bank, which would be a bank that whose purpose would be to lend money for infrastructure. Now, we have to get a capital base for the bank, and then we lend out a portion of that. Infrastructure is the most essential element for building up an economy, and an infrastructure bank would be the most important type of institution.
Well, Africa needs a special bank for infrastructure development to disentangle itself from the current debt burden. That's the opinion of our guest, Lawrence Freeman, and I would like to thank him for his incisive analysis today. And that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. It was great having you. Thanks a lot, and goodbye for now.
اون چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. People crowd the morning gatherings as soon as they learn that the words they will hear are those of the master of the Imam, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. One of the infallible Imams, possibly Imam Baqir, peace be upon him, said, "Assign me an elegy reciter at Mina." That wasn't because Imam Baqir needed such recitation personally. It had political connotation. Just visualize the place Mina during a Hajj pilgrimage. Thousands upon thousands of pilgrims gathered there from all over the world. Picture them observing a pilgrim singly reciting elegies for Imam Baqir, expressing the crime of his enemies in arranging Imam Hussein's martyrdom.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Muharram and the Ashura. In one of his speeches, he refers to a very important point about Imam Hussein, and he says that they killed the master of the martyrs, Sayyid al-Shuhada, but Islam flourished evermore. This small part of speech, this small sentence, had many things in it. The enemies of Imam Hussein, which was Yazid and the Banu Umayyah, they used to think that by killing Imam Hussein, they can have the victory. They can rule over the Islamic world. They can change the halal, the allowable things, or the halal of the Prophet to haram and haram to halal. This was their planning, and that's why they killed Imam Hussein. And that's why they wanted him to being killed. But Imam Hussein's sacrifice and martyrdom, Imam Hussein's martyrdom has proved that Islam flourished evermore.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu alayhi.
Islam was flourished after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, because a new wave of revolution started after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, and everyone was blaming Yazid to be the bad guy, as he was. Before that, when Yazid was the ruler and he was pretending to be the ruler of the Islam, he used to drink alcohol. He was performing the haram actions, and he was doing it as a leader or the king of a state. Whereas Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he rose against him. He raised his voice against Yazid ibn Muawiyah, and he basically unveiled the plans of Banu Umayyah, and he has saved and revived the Islam. Therefore, Islam flourished ever after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And we can see that because of this martyrdom, we had many times we had victory. The truth has victory over falsehood. Whenever we talk about truth, we talk about Imam Hussein. Whenever we talk about falsehood, we talk about Yazid and the characters like Yazid. Therefore, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, his martyrdom has flourished Islam evermore. And this is the martyrdom of Imam Hussein that made the Islamic Republic of Iran to have this revolution.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Dear listeners, my sisters and brothers from all around the world, welcome to For a Better Life. This is IRIB English Radio. I hope wherever you are, you're doing well. Welcome to another session of Literature Engaged with the Religion. This has been quite some sessions that we're discussing literature and the rich heritage that we have about Ashura. And we said that the poets have done a great deal of job through making and composing those poems. And we talk mostly about poems because those poems are usually used in those gatherings. And they could touch the heart of the audience very, very deeply. So that's why we mostly talk about them. Otherwise, we have some very great writings as well. There are some books that, as I told you, give you an account, authentic account of what happened step by step in the day of Ashura. But aside, apart from that, they have made some stories out of that. There is this book written in Persian that is very beautiful. It has been done for different characters. One of them is about Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas alayhi salam, that is called Saqqaya Abu Adab, because, as you know, he was the one who was responsible for bringing water for the children and for the women. So he's been called Saqqa. So literally, Saqqa is the one who provides the water. But at the same time, it goes that the title talks about his manners and his modesty, as well as being the provider of the water to everyone. So in this book, in each segment, in each chapter of this book, you could get familiar with the perspective of each member of the family regarding him. So one chapter looks at him from the viewpoint of a sister, another chapter, the nephew is talking about his uncle. And in another chapter, he's been described through the mouth of his mother. The story goes on. And it is very beautiful. You go through so much of emotions, so much of heart-touching descriptions that come to cross your mind. You could have some imagery of the situation as well. So I was just giving you an example of the fact that there is not just poems that's been done in this field. There's so much of books that will give you an account of each character, and they are so heart-touching, and they're mostly just like stories that have been created and put together in order to make that a story have a more real it is, of course, real, to get a new face in order to put them in a new form of conveying. Now, let's just go back to the poems that we were discussing. These elegiac poems mostly give you some hints about the people who have been in the battlefield. You know that in the camp of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, there were women, and to hear the story from the mouth of a woman is a totally different thing. And of course, it must be difficult from when you hear it from the mouth of a man, especially when that woman is a sister, when that woman is a mother, when that woman is a daughter. So it becomes so very much difficult and so very much heart-touching and very, very much sorrowful. There's this Arabic poem that has been attributed to Lady Zainab, Salamullah alayha. It goes like this. I have picked a very little part of it. I would read it in Arabic and then would give you the gist of it in English. It goes like this. بالأمس كانوا معي واليوم قد رحلوا وخلفوا في سويد القلب نيرانا نذرا علي لإن عادوا أو رجعوا لَأَزْرَعَنَّ طَرِيقَ الطَّفِّ رَيْحَانَا. But these very little poems, plenty of emotions and plenty of ideas would come to the mind of the reader, of the person who hears that. We mostly hear this in the gatherings that we come to cry for the sorrows of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. The meaning of that very little piece of a poetry was that yesterday I had a family that lived with me. We were together, and today I've lost them. There is no more of them. I have no one of them with me. I would promise, I would make an oath, if they come back, I would plant all the way of Karbala with flowers. So this is very, very, very delicate kind of a poetry to come to a mind of a poet and to bring it into paper. So if it is not about the purity of the mind and the heart of the poet, how else would a person come to get into these very delicate and heart-touching sort of issues? So there must be something spiritual about it. And now that we were talking about Lady Zainab, salamullah alayha, I would love to talk about the love that she shared with her brother. I would say the strongest hero of that battlefield is she herself, because as a sister, as a mother, and as an aunt, she has been going through the loss that is incredible. No one in this world have been through too much of sorrow as she went through. At the very same day, she lost her brothers, her sons, her nephews, and every single person of her family had been lost in that very day. So for a woman to tolerate all these much of pains, it seems as an inexplicable hard work, which is unbelievable, actually. To us, as natural, ordinary human beings, a single pain and loss would take us through so much of breakdowns. But she managed to be the leader of that journey. Allah, Allah, Subhanallah, Allah, Allah, walhamdulillah, Allah, Allah. This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Allah, Allah, walhamdulillah, ya Allah. You can listen to us at parstoday.com/en.
If you have any suggestion, our email is englishradio@irib.ir.
In some parts of our literature, we have that if it wasn't about Lady Zainab, then the story of Karbala would have faded away. If it wasn't about her and the sermons she made and the strength she showed to everyone, there would have never been so much of this story remaining to us, because through her mouth, everything has been passed down to other generations. And the poets also focus on her as the person who has been suffered more than anyone else in that battlefield, because she also had to take care of the orphans after the day of Ashura. So she had so much on her shoulder, and she managed to do it as strong as a man, not just a lady. That's why she becomes a model to all women who are living and who have been throughout the history searching for a role model to just rely on to learn things from. Of course, you would never reach to her strength or devotion or purity, but she has always been a model for every single woman in this world, because when a sorrow, when a loss happens to every one of us, we just come to think of her and say that, okay, all those much of sufferings, no one could compare herself to her, to Lady Zainab Salamullah Alayha. That's also another evidence of the love that's been shared through these poems. And thank you for listening.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has waded into the Tory leadership row over energy costs by declaring he's absolutely certain his successor will offer further help to households, as annual bills were forecast to top £4,200 by January. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Rowena Mason and Alex Lawson. The piece is titled "Johnson Absolutely Certain Next Prime Minister Will Offer More Help on Paying Bills." In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has waded into the Tory leadership row over energy costs by declaring he's absolutely certain his successor will offer further help to households, as annual bills were forecast to top £4,200 by January. Boris Johnson made an unexpected intervention on energy bills at a Number 10 reception, as Liz Truss, the front-runner to be the next Prime Minister, was accused by Rishi Sunak's campaign of being divorced from reality over her refusal to commit to more handouts. Boris Johnson has repeatedly refused to act on rocketing gas and electricity bills before leaving office on 5th of September, but said he was sure the next Prime Minister will be wanting to make some more announcements in September or October about what we're going to do further to help people in the next period in December and January. He added, "I just want you to know that I'm absolutely confident that we will have the fiscal firepower and the headroom to continue to look after people as we've done throughout." The deepening row over how to help households came on the day annual energy bills were forecast to exceed £4,200 from January, triggering a warning that Britons face serious hardship on a massive scale without government intervention. At the same time, government sources have admitted officials have modelled the possibility of a four-day power shortage in the first quarter of next year, potentially requiring rolling blackouts for industry and households. Boris Johnson's comments add further pressure on Liz Truss to acknowledge that, as Prime Minister, she would need to give households more help beyond tax cuts. As Liz Truss doubled down on her plan for reversing the national insurance rise and removing £150 of green levies, a Sunak campaign spokesperson said her proposals will not touch the sides for the majority of British families this winter, and pensioners will get no help whatsoever. The consultancy Cornwall Insight said on Tuesday, 9th of August, that it expected the energy price cap to reach £4,266 a year for the first 3 months of next year, more than triple the level it was at a year previously and more than double the current level. Any shortages of energy over the winter caused by less gas and less electricity from Norway and the rest of Europe could push prices up even further. But Liz Truss said at the weekend that she does not want to give handouts to people struggling with bills, preferring to prioritise tax cuts. She repeatedly refused to promise any further help on energy bills on Tuesday, 9th of August, only confirming plans to reverse the recent increase in national insurance and to temporarily suspend green levies on energy bills. Liz Truss doubled down on her economic stance on Tuesday night by brandishing cash handouts to help with the cost of living as Gordon Brown economics. Speaking at Conservative hustings in Darlington, which was dominated by questions on bills, the Foreign Secretary underlined that she believed the best route to help with the cost of living crisis was cutting taxes, starting with national insurance. Liz Truss said, "I didn't agree with raising national insurance. We promised not to do it in our manifesto, and we need to help those people who are struggling with the cost of living. We need to be on the side of the self-employed. We need to be on the side of people who work and do the right thing, and we need to enable people to keep more of their own money. Those are conservative principles," she said. Liz Truss added, "What I don't support is taking money off people in tax and then giving it back to them in handouts. That, to me, is Gordon Brown economics." Rishi Sunak, in turn, warned that the British people will not forgive us if vulnerable households did not get extra direct help this winter. The former Chancellor Rishi Sunak said Liz Truss's plans would not help swathes of the population and said that whoever was Prime Minister should not rule out direct support. Truss has said she will emphasise tax cuts rather than committing to giving extra direct help with energy bills. "If you're a pensioner, if you're on the national living wage, tax cuts are worth zero," the former Chancellor said. "That's not a policy to help people get through the winter, and I think it's wrong to rule out help directly because we as a Conservative government have an obligation to help those who are most vulnerable. If we don't do that, not only will people suffer, but we will get absolutely hammered when it comes to the next election. The British people will not forgive us for not doing that." Critics of her policy warned that tax cuts disproportionately help the better off and offer no assistance to pensioners or those not in work, while the green levies contribute only about £150 annually to the average bill. What's vitally important at this moment is we get economic growth going, Liz Truss told reporters on a visit to Huddersfield in West Yorkshire. At the moment, we've got the highest taxes in 70 years. That's why I believe in lower taxes to get economic growth going, to encourage businesses to invest, and that way there will be more money in people's pockets. Asked if she was ruling out any other help for energy bills, Liz Truss replied, "What I am promising is that from day one, people will have lower taxes. They will also have lower energy bills because I'm going to put a temporary moratorium on the green energy levy. But what we need is a growing economy." Meanwhile, Rishi Sunak confirmed in an interview with ITV that he would be likely to offer a few hundreds of pounds in rebates on energy bills after the rise is confirmed. On Monday, 8th of August, the Liberal Democrats called for an energy furlough scheme in which the government financed the complete cost of any rise to the energy price cap in October. While the Labour Party has said it would provide extra assistance to households financed by ending tax breaks for energy firms, one of the party's backbenchers has argued it should go much further. In an article for The Guardian, Zara Sultana said that since Boris Johnson took on board Labour's idea for a windfall tax on energy firms in May, her party isn't offering enough to people struggling with their bills. The Coventry South MP, Zara Sultana, has set up a campaign called Enough is Enough to seek more action on the cost of living.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed.
His decree, though...
Ya ilaha kull shay'in wa malika ya rabba.
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah.
Ya khaliqa kull shay'in wa waritha.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Foresight and I'm your host Mahdi. When it comes to the different types of nourishment of the soul, just as the nourishment of the body, we have good things that will nourish our body and we have things that will damage our body. And likewise, we have mixtures and things for the soul which are a detriment to the soul and which in fact weaken our ubudiyyah. And so when talking about the nourishment of the soul which increases and strengthens our ubudiyyah, we find of course that the daily prayers, the different rituals and customs that we do in our daily lives, as well as the recitation of the Holy Quran, the du'as and the supplications given to us by the Ahlul Bayt. All of these are formal actions that we can do in order to provide nourishment to our soul. This nourishing of the soul with good and healthy nourishment will in fact increase and strengthen our ubudiyyah. Just as when we eat good food, healthy food, our body is strengthened. But not only are the different kinds of obedience and the different kinds of worship to Allah help us in nourishing our soul. Matter of fact, when we do good deeds, when we do good actions,